much, they were just about as natural as they could have been in terms of their actions the following morning. I just couldn't have asked for anything better. It was a good group of students, good group of people. Now, as I would say, you don't get generally real radicals in the public administration field, and hence I wasn't dealing with people who were all out leaders in any of the campus activities. Yeah. That most of them were more or less in the anti-Cambodian group, I think, was true. Mm-hmm. But that's a thought and not something I ever tried to test. I didn't think it was my business. And so,
one begins here. You said they weren't TAs because they were master's students.
Yes, there could have been a graduate, there could have been a PhD candidate or two in that seminar. I don't recall, but I don't believe there were any TAs in that group. I think that they were all master's degree candidates, all getting their degrees in the Center for Public Policy Administration, all going into government service. And that's my memory of it. I don't believe there was a TA in the group. I have TAs occasionally in those seminars, but I don't believe it was true then.
Did you have anything to do with any TAs during
I
the TA
had
strike?
Very little to do with the TAs during the TA strike because we don't use TAs in our graduate courses, and I've been almost exclusively teaching graduate courses in the last 12 years.
But some of them might have been TAs and been
striking. Yes, yes, they could have been. I guess I remember once starting to come on the campus, and a man whom I'm quite sure was a TA, whom I knew quite well, said to me, simply because he was being protective and for no other reason, "I don't think you ought to go up on the hill because there's been difficulties and the police are there and there is tear gas." He said, "I think you really ought not." But this was a purely protective kind of statement by this young man who had, I think he'd been up there or had started up there and discovered there were problems. I really was pretty much aside from those kinds of issues in that period. I had my own views about it.
What were they?
What were what?
Your views about the TA strike.
Oh, no, no. I didn't particularly mean views on the TA. Well, I guess my view on the TA strike, like my view on most of these things, is that I didn't think the university was the appropriate forum. That if we are going to maintain universities of quality and distinction, you can't have them spending a great part of time into opposition to whatever particular issue at any particular moment the students or individual faculty members may oppose that the government's doing. It's been clearly one of the very major problems in the German universities, the East German universities, but the West German universities too, and some of the other universities around the world. I've listened to George Mossy and others talk about some of the real horrors of the quality of university at the Free University in Berlin, for instance, where they really just can lay no pretense to being a university anymore. I've what people view as their, what they assume as their political views, is their freedom to do that, and they're free to vote, to do all the other things that seem to, that are hopefully going to, from their point of view, hopefully going to achieve what they want. But I just don't see interrupting the operation of the university as being a legitimate activity in this. People differ on this. I just don't happen to believe that's a legitimate activity.
Their grievances in forming the TAA in terms of pay and hours and that sort of thing, were you sympathetic with those? Or?
Well, you know, I think apparently there were some departments where there were problems. In a department such as ours, where being a TA had previously been one of the major achievements, and where I don't think we ever had more than a dozen or 14 TAs at the very most. I don't recall the actual number. Maybe it got up as high as 20. But we had a relatively small group of TAs with whom we generally interacted quite well and quite readily. And so that this department is not a department that had reason to be as involved as some. I think the departments where you really had big difficulties and had issues and some were some of the language departments and English and so forth. Now, of course, I don't want to suggest that every large department with large numbers of TAs had trouble. Obviously, chemistry has always stood out as not having trouble, despite the fact it had almost 100 TAs. We've had TAs organized. I believe the last strike with our TAs were pretty much involved. That had nothing to do, of course, with Vietnam. But I think that became almost an ideological matter of agreement that unions were of themselves something that was politically well to support. I think it had almost nothing to do
with the TAs.
Yes.
Or do you mean by the faculty?
No, I'm talking about the TAs.
But I mean that the faculty, of course, Ed Young approved of the idea of their having a union. Or at least recognize them.
I think Ed had varying views on this, depending on the situations. But I'm talking about the idea that our TAs in the last TA strike, what was it, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, whenever it was, our TAs were more united at that point than they had been in any of the previous ones. And I think the reason they supported the union was less for any benefits they expected or demanded or felt entitled to than it was a view that it was desirable to support the idea of collective bargaining for TAs. I wasn't discussing faculty views here at all.
Yeah, no, because there obviously the people who were in labor economics, for instance, would have a more of an assumption that it was a reasonable thing to do that the TAs might organize than people who were not themselves.
I think there were variations on that, although certainly some of the labor economists I know are absolutely against faculty collective bargaining, so that the two are to some degree intertwined almost inevitably. Anyway, that's what I observed of the situation. But as I say, because I wasn't using TAs, that time was almost entirely related to the center, and the center itself doing all graduate work doesn't use TAs. I was always sort of more of an observer than a very tightly involved participant. I should add that I do know colleagues who ceased to use TAs since they would not get themselves involved in all the detailed rules. Mm-hmm. And I know that happened on occasion. And I know that happened in other departments than this. So that in fact, the net result of much of the TA collective bargaining and strikes was to reduce the number of TA positions actually available. And these were individual faculty member decisions. They were not anything that was a departmental decision or a university decision or anything else. But some people just didn't want to have to bother with all the rules and regulations they felt they'd be tangled up with.
Did Ed Young ever talk to you before he recognized the TAA or consult with you about what your views were?
No, I have no memory of that. There wouldn't have been any particular reason to. Now, I've forgotten when the TA was actually
Well, 1969.
Yeah, all right. Then there wasn't any reason I would have been involved. I was trying to think. When I was on the university committee, there was some bargaining between the university and the TAA group. And there was discussion. It mostly, as I recall those discussions, it mostly had to do with issues that faculty members considered a faculty prerogative, and only incidentally salary, because salary, of course, was always something that was more or less set up by the legislature. There were some other elements.
Not being made a no, vice chancellor.
No. Not at my age.
I just am curious. Many people do seem to feel that the TAs had legitimate grievances, although many feel that in their own departments this wasn't the case.
But I think that's
in 1968 and 1969, and I'm just wondering what your attitude to that
was. My trouble is that I was one of these people that you heard all the discussions, but I wasn't involved, and consequently, I feel like my memory could be faulty, and moreover, I'm repeating only what other people said.
I mean, you yourself didn't at that time say, well, yes, they ought to have this or that, or they're not. You know, there were inequities of pay among different departments, that sort of thing.
Well, of course, you know, most people didn't know differences among departments and didn't know some of the ways in which a few departments handled it. And repeatedly, the story has been that it was the language departments and perhaps the English department where they had large numbers of TAs, where they tended to put off much of the freshman teaching or beginning teaching on these people, and perhaps didn't always recompense them exactly the same as others. Now, part of the difficulty could have been, which could easily be said, was that the normal teaching load in the language departments, at least, has frequently been somewhat higher, and I'm talking about faculty members, been somewhat higher than it has been in other departments. Mm. And so consequently, the faculties there may not have been as conscious that they were asking more because they themselves were being asked to do a little more. When most departments had a three-course load, the language departments often had a four-course load. Mm-hmm. And part of this reflected the old idea that much of the teaching was repetitious and required very little preparation, not the same kinds of preparation that was required in other departments. And I think even today that if you were to check around departments in this university, you would find that the teaching loads are not identical.
Well, I know they're not.
And I think that perhaps some of the problems the language departments had with their TAs came about because they were in turn putting on the TAs some of the kinds of burdens that they themselves had. I don't know that. I only suspect it could be true. But I'm really not the person to explore this detail.
No, it was just your view. I know. I mean,
there are other people that have much more detailed knowledge. I guess having been one of these people who grew up in the New Deal period, etc., and believing on the one hand that industrial labor unions were absolutely necessary and absolutely critical, that I do not feel the same way in professions, and saw neither support collective bargaining for faculty, nor necessarily viewed the TAs as requiring that in order to get a fair deal. But that was a kind of general view of it without detailed knowledge.
Yeah, could I push you a bit further on that? The Mulvihill Report came out in 1968 in detailing a number of steps that should be taken to improve the condition of the TAs. And it's been one of the complaints, and many faculty members have spoken of it, that the faculty never dealt with this report, that never made any effort to implement any of these. Do you remember that, the Mulvihill report, and do you, well, you must have been on the Senate, or I mean, going to faculty meetings at that time?
Well, the Senate. Yes, I've forgotten what year the Senate was established.
Not till the 70s.
Was it 70? By 71, I know, yeah. And just when before that. I have to admit that there have been so many faculty reports. I remember there was a Mulvihill report. I've always had great confidence in Bob Mulvihill's general judgment. And if the faculty felt that it had never been, they had never dealt with it, obviously they could have if they'd wanted to. Nobody can say
you
couldn't.
They instead of we.
Well, I guess I said they instead of we because I don't recall complaining about it, and therefore I'm saying those people who felt that they had not had a chance to discuss it could have done so if they had wanted to. So this is the only reason I use the they,
yeah,
we here.
Right.
I think one of the problems you always get into in those things, and I suspect this is the answer in this case, is that you can look at a report like that, you can look at the recommendations, and you can say to yourself, well, our department's not involved. Our department does this. And I would say that in terms of political science, we did, I'll bet we followed everything that was, or almost everything that was recommended by that report. But, as you know, university departments are little kingdoms.
Yeah,
and they don't want to be dictated to the other little kingdoms, and they don't want to be dictated to.
But this is different, because this isn't individual department decisions. What he was recommending was a general faculty adoption of a number of rules which the administration was involved in. For instance, one was that the chancellor would have a committee of TAs that would meet regularly. In fact, it may be that Ed Jung actually did.
I suspect that was adopted. I think he did adopt it. I still go back to the proposition that very often in this university, we get a report like that, and bits of it will be adopted by the administration, and individual departments may adopt part of it. But we don't, we have a strong tendency not to tell the other department what it ought to do.
Yeah,
and even though you see those as broad rules, but you see, that isn't the way they would be translated in a faculty meeting.
Eventually, the affirmative action program was done that
sure.
way.
I know it was, and it was.
And I guess the notion is that the same thing should have been done for the at
well,
that time.
You're. I don't say whether it should or shouldn't. I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm really not trying to deal with that, but I'm trying to deal with the procedural thing.
Yeah.
It's a very important one because we get into it in government. People who've got bright ideas as to how to improve a whole series of things are quite willing to write rules and regulations for the other fellow. But when the other fellow's got a different kind of sense of what he needs rules and regulations for, then all of a sudden my individual freedom and independence becomes very important, and I don't want those darn rules over there. And we do the same thing in the university. And historically, if you look at the rules of this campus, we have now gotten into a whole lot more rules than we ever had before. And this is a protest. There are people who protest as an interference with the department.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the case of this report, I think these reports are important, and they often have an impact even when they don't get adopted as policy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, for instance, certainly the TAs in any individual department could have brought up this report as a base for change. Certainly, and I'm sure you're right that Ed Jung did adopt the idea of a TA committee and some of the things from the point that was a practical for the chancellor's office to do. I'm sure he did it. I know, for instance, that Ed Jung is very fond of Bob Mulvihill, trusts his judgment, has worked with him a lot, so that I would find it almost inconceivable that Ed wouldn't have taken on what he could do unilaterally.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I suspect that's what happened. So what remains are the things that, were you telling every department they had to conform in this way, or weren't you, or were you going to let them operate as they decided to achieve this. And I suspect the latter is true, and I think it simply, again, represents this question of how much you're going to rule centrally via the departments and how much you're going to let the departments make their own decisions. Now, this didn't always work out well. I'm not defending it as producing perhaps the kind of results you would prefer, but I think it's what happens.
But aren't there across the board rules, say, for retirement?
And, oh, sure.
I mean, that's all I mean, that the faculty does...
Oh, yes, but the more you get in that, retirement hasn't very much to do with an individual department. It has very little to do. But the TA does have quite a bit to do with an individual department. How you make your decisions about selecting your TAs, how much role an individual faculty member who is going to use a TA has in the selection of that TA, these sorts of things become very significant to the individual faculty member and to the department. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of hours and pay, I'm sufficiently hazy about that I don't want to get into it. Presumably, there always were concepts of what represented a third-time or half-time TA. Now, we usually had third-time TAs. The language departments usually had half-time TAs, and I think the English department usually had half-time TAs. Now, I'm also sure there was a kind of sense of how many hours were involved for these two different things, but I think it's entirely possible that what was expected to be accomplished might in some cases be less feasible than in others to be achieved within the hours that we're talking about here.
Yes. That is Sparrows, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, I think it is.
Well, that's
part of it is the machine. There are two elements of faculty governance here. One is the division between the administration and the faculty. And given the way our faculty meetings or faculty senates or so on operate, there is nothing that a faculty member can't bring up for discussion if he wishes to do so. Mm-hmm. How it will be handled is a different question, but that it can be brought up and some discussion take place. But there's not only the issue of faculty governance between the administration and the faculty, but there's the issue of faculty governance within departments. And our faculty governance, the most significant part of it is within departments. It's because of what is left to departments to determine that really constitutes a bulk of our important faculty governance. Mm. This is where decisions are made about hiring, promotions, salaries, etc. And the major decisions are all there. Well, naturally, many departments see as integral to that the hiring of TAs, the kinds of contracts they agree with them on, the kinds of notices they give them, and so on. Now, some of this has been taken away from them. And I'm sure there are faculty members who feel that their role as a faculty member in faculty governance has been diminished because they have less control over what kind of a TA they have and what kinds of roles they have with it. So therefore, what I was simply trying to suggest before is that you've got major differences among departments here, and some things that may seem like very logical and reasonable and may be perfectly reasonable and rational may affect different departments differently, and departments may suddenly, individuals in departments who normally may be on one side of an issue may suddenly revert if they find that this is going to interfere with their role within their department. And it's this kind of thing that I was trying to suggest makes this distinction. When you get reports that may look like very good reports, very appropriate reports, very much on time, and then not much happens to them. Mm-hmm. And especially as of what not much happens to them is something that is generally within the control of the faculty members. My guess is that mostly this is when you don't want to come bang up against another department.
Yeah.
And they're very sensitive on that. You go to Senate meetings time after time, and well, a lot of the discussion and the points of view you can predict in advance because there are always a few faculty members who like to talk and who always have their position. But you'll be amused at times that suddenly one of these people that's always taken a particular position has suddenly reverted and is on the opposite side of the issue. Well, that usually means that this is something that affects them in their departmental capacity. And so that's my suspicion, without knowledge here, my suspicion of what happened in this case.
Right. This is your chairmanship.
Yes. Well, the early 60s saw a tremendous expansion in the number of faculty members, in the number of students, in the amount of support. Because we got substantial money through the National Defense Education Act. Mm. This was very important to us.
With the fellowships.
And then it was also the period in which we were suddenly having many opportunities for overseas research work. Mm-hmm. So that the emphasis or the demand for support was actually being fulfilled fairly well at that time because of the Ford money, the federal grant money, and always a little bit of money around the university that we seemed to get. I suppose there's never a time in which some people didn't want more research money than they had. But my recollection as chairman was that one of the problems we were dealing with was leaves of absence and having to be sure we had coverage for it. It's so that I do not have the sense that we were seriously involved in that. Now there were two or three things, and I think the one thing happened after I was chairman. In recruiting, we had certain types of problems. And one of the problems that we definitely had difficulty with was our course load, which tended to be higher than other institutions. So we attempted to make a lot of adjustments, try to find ways in which faculty members could have some kind of support from this money or that money. And of course, there was some Rennabaum money coming in. There were some other funds coming from a few sources. So there was some money that the graduate school could assist us with. And eventually, and I think it must have been by somewhat later, we did reduce the course load in effect, whether we officially did it or not. And this, we felt, was the most necessary thing we needed in order to recruit the quality of faculty members.
What,
we
need two courses?
It's essentially two courses. It partly was achieved by changing the amount of credits that you got for the courses, so that whereas a 9 or 10 credit load had been the norm in the past, which meant three courses, we stretched this to sort of an 8 credit load, and by changing the amount of credits of certain courses, it tended to get toward 8 credits. But the effect of all of this was a 2-course load, and this was achieved, I think, after I was chairman, and somewhat later in the 60s. But that was one of the real problems we had in recruiting. Just very definitely it was the course load, because Harvard and Yale and Chicago, the places we generally competed with for faculty members, had a 2-course load without any question. And in initial hiring, I don't recall we had much trouble on salary. We could usually get a competitive salary at the initial hiring point. What happened later was a different matter, but at the initial hiring point, we could get a competitive salary. And Most people in their beginning aren't going to ask you great details about whether your retirement system is adequate or comparable to other people's retirement systems. So on those issues, we weren't too badly off. It was almost entirely on the issue of course load and the general sense of what quality department this is, what are my chances of going ahead, being somebody here, you know, that sort of thing. But I would say the course load was more important to us in those years than the amount of research funds we had access to, which I'm not saying weren't important, but I think for recruiting, and I'm really thinking more for recruiting, I think that was more important. Now, I do know that during my chairmanship, we shifted out of the chairman's office the placement of graduate students who were finishing their degrees. Up to that point, the chairman had usually been responsible for attempting, along with the major professor, of course, always the major professor. But to the extent we attempted to operate a centralized placement activity for PhD students, that had been done more or less in the chairman's office, and that shifted to a separate faculty member responsibility. And the fellowship thing was separate. The recruiting still was in the chairman's office. I did 90% of all the initial, maybe even higher.
For side one.
90% of all the initial, maybe even higher than that, of all the initial work in recruiting. I called chairman, I remember particularly a chairman at Yale with whom I was on very close terms, and actually there was one at Harvard, and I would just call him. Once I actually went out and did a field recruiting of meeting people in New York City and meeting people in Cambridge and so forth. I think that's about the only time that was ever done. And there was some thought that it would be cheaper for a pre-screening by the chairman than bringing too many people here in the Madison. But that was that. Now, in subsequent years, and I don't know the time it became true, there has tended to be more a committee type of recruiting for different areas of the department.
Wait, I think I'll just take four side two. Did you recruit new graduate students, or were you trying to recruit more senior people?
We mostly recruited junior faculty, and that was true with a few exceptions. Austin Ranney had been recruited while Leon was chairman, and Murray Edelman, I guess, was recruited while I was chairman. And subsequently, of course, we recruited, not when I was chairman, Matthew Holden, and a few others of a more senior level. But our general policy had been to recruit at the beginning level and hope that they would work out well and would stay.
Your policy, what you expected them to become tenured.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, some departments took a whole lot of people and didn't.
Yes. No, we didn't. We were not in the practice of taking more junior people than we presumed we had tenure slots for. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, everybody who came here who was selected to come here as an assistant professor and instructor, if he didn't have his doctorate, could get tenure here if he worked out satisfactorily, he or she. They didn't have to be competing against each other. In fact, I don't think we have In the almost 30 years I've been here, I don't think we've ever had a situation where we actually had juniors competing against each other for a limited number of slots. Now, I don't say we won't reach that situation, although it still looks fairly respectable on it. But either because some people dropped out or some people weren't satisfactory or this or that happened. And our intention was never to recruit more people than we had tenure slots for. We never practiced that at any point since I've been here. And I know that varies with departments, and it varies in some part for good reason. The English department used to do that in a very substantial way, and I was, that was partly because they hired for freshman teaching, even when they didn't use TAs there, and therefore there was a limit to how long those people would stay in a freshman teaching position, and so they did it. But we didn't have that kind of situation. No, the only other thing that you might be interested in that I think of, this is incidental, but nevertheless not totally unimportant. We moved from South Hall to North Hall the fall that I was chairman. And actually in the previous year, or at least the previous 4, 5, 6 months, after it was evident I was going to become, well, I guess it was even before I was evident I was going to become chairman. Leon had said to me one day, "Clara, somehow I think women know more about buildings than men do. Would you mind being a committee of one and sort of watching over the transfer to North Hall?" And I said, "Sure, I didn't mind doing that." And so I did. And I think it's true that this was the first building that got more than one color painted. I was sick and tired of seeing only buff colors in all the walls, and I think so we did, we even matched a bit in terms of flooring and things like that, which didn't cost a bit extra. It was just a matter of thinking about it. So I practically was in a situation where I'd go down to lunch at the union, and every noon as I'd come back from lunch I'd stop in here. And I there was one wild thing that happened. I saw a fire hose that was seemingly going, or there was an area that looked like that was going into one of our faculty offices, and I finally asked what was going in there, and they said the fire hose. And I said, "Within a faculty office?" "Oh yes." Well, it took a few calls, but the fire hose box didn't get built into the faculty office. And there were a few things like that that were kind of amusing and amazing. But it's true that I did find, for example, that at least at that point, the building people never had a list of what ought to go into every single room. It seemed to me that would be obvious. And for example, because I didn't pay attention to the classrooms, and there were two or three classrooms in here, when it got all done, it turned out there were no electric outlets. There were lights, but no electric outlets in the room. And there, and in some of the faculty offices, because these had originally been faculty or had been classrooms, there were no screens on the window. It seemed to me that those sorts of things, I would have assumed as a person looking over remodeling, that I would have a list of things that automatically had to be checked for every building. But I discovered at least in 1963 that wasn't true. I don't know what the situation is today. But basically we got a quite satisfactory building. I know Leon was very pleased with the results, and I think the department as a whole was pleased when we came into the building and the condition it was in. We had simply gotten too big for South Hall, where the old Ness Dean's office was, and the mathematics had been in this building, and of course everything has been in this building since it's the oldest building on the campus. And we took over when mathematics went into Van Vleck.
Seems to me I remember Leon saying something about, or somebody saying something about, the political science feeling that it had fallen through several holes in getting a building that...
Well, there had been discussion of whether the social science building that has economics and sociology and anthropology, whether we would be housed there. And then there was a brief flurry of discussion of housing us with law. which Law didn't take very kindly to. And I, what happened in the case of the social science building, I'm not totally sure. There was some view that Bill Young and Jim McCamey didn't particularly want to go over there, and that they influenced that decision. Whatever was the facts, and we did get this building, and it has both the advantages and disadvantages of being the oldest building on the campus. It's not all one way or the other.
Yes, I'm sure of that. It's got nice thick walls.
That's right. It's got nice thick walls, and it has many attractive aspects of it. And as chairman, I had the third floor corner office looking over the lake and the woods, so I didn't exactly complain about that. The other dramatic thing in connection with that was that we actually moved. We were in the process of moving on the day that President Kennedy was assassinated. And we were very much involved in the, I mean, we were all involved in getting moved and all, you know, all the upsetness that you get in that kind of, and we went, and several of us went down to the Union for lunch, which where we generally ate lunch at that time in the department. And I still recall Jack Barbash came over and told us the news that, and at that point they didn't know whether he had died or not. And everybody sort of came wandering back to North Hall, and there was a telephone man here who was installing telephones, and he had a radio, and everybody kind of gathered around him. And then when the news came that he had died, everybody just dispersed. It was very interesting to see how people behave in that sort of situation.
Went home, you mean?
Or dispersed around the building to their own offices or something. There was almost, once it was known, there was no immediate general discussion. They just sort of, as I said, dispersed, whether going home or to their offices or whatever they did at that stage. So yeah, the move has always had a certain drama connected with it. I'm not sure that I think of any other major events. If I were to reread the department minutes for that period, I might be tempted to talk about some other things that happened during my chairmanship. But I think as a whole, it went off fairly uneventfully, except for the general growth that was going on throughout the university then. And of course, budgets were loose. I don't think I mentioned this earlier, but I've always recalled the story that when Ed Young was leaving, I went over to say goodbye and to tell him that that I'd appreciated working with him and that I enjoyed him as dean and all the sorts of things you normally say. And Ed, being Ed, first poo-pooed it and then said, "Clara, it's awfully easy to be a good dean when budgets are going up and up." I've never forgotten that. It was true for chairman, it was true for deans. It's a much tougher thing today for deans and chairman when budgets are very tight.
Yes, you had, by 66 it was still all right, wasn't it?
The budgets continued actually to grow substantially until almost the middle 70s.
Stephen Kleene was dean in the early 70s. There was a terrible period of,
well, all right,
I thought so too, but I've been looking at,
well, that may be true. And of course part of that would have been all the adjustment during merger, so that the exact way in which the budgets were being divided and all these things would have come up in those early years, which may have affected it. But I'd sort of forgotten. I suspect if you actually looked at the budgets, they were still going up, but you did have increases. You had increased pressures on the budget at that period, I'm sure. And we also, once you've had close to 10 years of, or more than 10 years of growing budgets, it's always hard to even take a stable budget. And I think that's what was happening in part. But I don't want to be precise about the dates because I haven't looked at those figures recently.
You expressed some, when I mentioned Jim Scott the other day, you expressed some, and I said, that I understood he left here because his wife wanted a job. You expressed some doubt about that.
I guess I shouldn't have expressed that. I suspect that was right. It was also obviously true. And this is not uncommon. Jim went back to where he got his PhD. And Yale earned his degree. And I think there's always a certain kind of satisfaction in going out and spreading your wings and doing well enough that you get back to your home alma mater where your PhD was earned. So I think there was a good bit of that in Jim's view. That's all I meant on that. Dave Feldman and I were talking about, I was mentioning the fact that you had asked the question and I as to why people seem to have less institutional loyalty, assuming that's true, and that I had said I thought that part of this was the availability of grants and funds that people competed for nationally. And Dave certainly agreed with me on that. He added, though, which I'm sure that I know he's also obviously right, is that this was a period of expansion, so the opportunities for people to move had expanded very greatly. Mm-hmm. He tells that when he went to school in Nebraska in the mid-20s, that there were some very outstanding faculty members there who would have been stars in many good institutions, but mm-hmm. who had spent their whole life there. And the tendency has always been that where you get your first job can be extremely critical as what kind of career you have, but that was peculiarly true when faculties are very, very stable or even decreasing, and there is very little competition, very few people reaching out to find somebody good. So that I think that your lessening of institutional loyalty both is a question of the great availability, much increased availability of grants, and therefore a national competition, but also the fact that so many departments were looking around the country because they needed more people, and they didn't want to get too unbalanced to staff with all just beginners, and therefore they were looking around the country, where is there somebody that's really done something that we'd be happy to have on our faculty. And so I think both those things were very important in the 60s and 70s. I don't know anything else on that particular area that you may want.
I don't think of anything.
You ask what difference I saw between Ed Young and Leon Epstein, who were the two deans when I was chairman. And I would respond that for me, at least, the difference was probably minimal, perhaps more minimal than for some people, because on the one hand, Ed has always been a fairly relaxed administrator, and he was certainly a relaxed dean at a period when budgets were very generous. And I had a very free and easy relationship with him. I'd heard stories of chairman years ago dealing with a dean where they were practically shaking when they went to talk to him. That there was never even remotely my experience dealing with Ed Young or Leon Epstein. And of course, as far as Leon was concerned, I'd worked with him so carefully, or so long, and he had been chairman of the department, so he knew the department so well, so that there too, and the budgets continued to be generous, there too there was a relaxed relationship, so that I don't ever remember having any conflict with either one of them. Certainly there might have been a disagreement over some minor thing, but it must have been so minor that it completely escapes me as anything that I do remember once when Ed gave us a budget request arrangement where we could divide up a certain amount of money for salary increases, and then there was a second column in which you could put down sort of what you would like to see people get if money were not much of an object. And and when I went over to talk to him about our budget, he said, I gave you everything you asked for. And I said, well, I didn't think he'd quite done that, that there was, you know, there were these questions and so forth in my second column, and I still remember Ed just looking at me and saying, you and your second column. but apart from those kinds of obvious differences that anybody would have and which are not serious from an administrator's point of view, I can't recall any difficulty, either in selection of faculty members or in promotions or in budget items.
We were lucky.
Well, it was the budget period in part, plus, of course, the quality of the deans, but it was a budget period. You have to, that always has to be recognized. I had some differences later when I was director of the center, and then I dealt with Steve Claney, and occasionally there I felt I had to exert a great deal more pressure to get things that I thought the center ought to have, which of course was not quite a department, was, and is not quite a department, but kind of a semi-department, this type of situation, and it was new, it was an additional item in the budget, and so forth. I got along all right with Steve, but given both the fact that the center was an additional item in the budgets were not quite as generous as they had been, for reasons such as that, I probably had to exert more pressure, or try to exert more pressure, to get closer to what I was seeking with Cleaney than I did with the other two.
Did you shake in your boots when you went to Cleaney?
No, I never shook in my boots when I went to see Steve Cleaney. Occasionally
that
must
one
have could
been celery, the movie.
Yes, I'm sure it was celery. The reference was too.
Yeah.
The only problem with Steve Cleaney was that his hearing was not is not too good, and once in a while you might think you had an agreement with him that it turned out you didn't because he hadn't really heard you, and I did have one instance of that kind. Mm-hmm. And I remember laying out the problem then in a letter and getting a reply that under those circumstances, yes, of course it was all right. Mm-hmm. And so this was one of those physical handicaps problems that you need to be aware of if the other person has it or if you have it.
Mm. Tell me how you organize your time, your work day, and then generally your time for research and for writing versus teaching administration.
Well, I have some sense of organization, but I'm not sure I've got as much sense of organization as one needs. I usually try to set certain days as being times that I would spend more on a research project and other days that I would spend in preparation for teaching or dealing with students. And of course, in the times when I had administrative responsibilities, I usually was teaching less so that and I would also have to add, I didn't do too much in research in some of those periods. I simply turned over more time to administration and gave less time to some of these others. I think that sometimes that can be very difficult, and I suppose at least one of the years when I was, and perhaps it was a year I was chairman of the university committee, the conflict and demands of the university committee and the needs there and the routine of administration of being director of the center at times lessened the amount of opportunity that I had to either to prepare my own teaching or to talk with students in the center program. And that told eventually, and that's simply when anybody, and in this case it was myself, has more demands than they can actually fulfill in the number of hours that they can work, and that occasionally happens. But most of the time, I think most of us tend to put our teaching responsibilities and our seeing student responsibilities pretty much at the top, and then let our research work take second place. But that depends, and depends on situations. You can't generalize completely. Sometimes if you're at the very completing something, then you may try to shake off a bit of the responsibility on the teaching side. You do it, but you may not come as well prepared or have brought in all the newest information. Those are circumstances that you try to control.
Do you always have a research project going?
I think that in some sense I've always had a research project going. You're trying to think through what you want to do next, but most of the time you've got some kind of overlap between what you're finishing and what you're thinking about, and or you're working on. I did one book for you know, that's a sign type of book that you use in a class, a regular textbook, and I did a chapter in a couple of books that were used as textbooks. Well, even when you're doing that sort of thing, you often are aware of areas that you don't know much about and that there doesn't seem to be much writing on. And if something appeals to you of that nature, then you sort of are thinking about what you can do on that for your next research and writing. I haven't been an enormously productive scholar. On the other hand, if all the writing I had done were put together, it would be what I would consider a respectable amount, not enormous. Certainly I have colleagues who have done a great deal more in research and writing. Mine, I put it kind of middle level.
Do you enjoy writing? Do you find it difficult?
I find writing difficult. I find, as most people do, I suspect, that it's great fun to go out and do the much of the research work, whether it's library work or interviewing or whatever, or organizing your material and putting it together and thinking about things. But when you have to sit down and really put it together, and I don't have great literary skill, and this always troubles me as I write, and I just don't find writing that much fun. It's one of the things you have to do. There's no point in the research if you're not going to write it up. Nobody else is ever going to have any value from it. Whatever value is there is going to be there only if you write it up. And so I don't find it easy to write. Some people, I think, find it easier than I do. I think most people find writing difficult to some extent.
Do you make drafts?
Normally I do. I make a draft. I type. My writing is poor, and of course, in more recent years, I've had some arthritis in my fingers, and I find typing. I think on the typewriter. I also do what is probably wasteful on a typewriter. I write something and I don't like it. And maybe I correct it, and then I retype the whole thing. Maybe if I were to learn, start over again, I'd learn some of these new computer methods of typing, and where you can make your changes in right on the machine and can go ahead. And I think this would save time if one were to do it that way. The very modern word processing machines, which I've never used at all, apparently would help with some of this. I've tried dictating, but I can only do that in a limited fashion for limited types of reports, or obviously for letters and so forth. There are just a few. I don't find dictating an easy way to think. I think, now again, I think that just as a word processing machines, or as typing as I do, I know people who've done all their writing by writing it out. Dave Feldman has done an enormous amount of writing. He always writes his out. He never does. Handwritten. It's all handwritten.
most of these are things you have to work at. And at some stage, I worked at composing on the typewriter till I find that the normal way to compose. I'm sure if one were to work hard enough at it, one could learn to compose and by dictating, and one certainly could learn to compose on these new word processing machines. But you do have to work at it. There are different thought processes in your own ways of thinking and in your brain, the way you operate, which way you're doing. I like to look at what I've just written and see whether that fits. I'm pretty good at outlining. I tend to have a fairly substantial outline of what I'm going from to where and the points of that outline. I tend to be quite structural minded in that sense. I think it's valuable to do it that way. And I think that value is pretty consistent for most people. Though some types of work, I'm sure some kinds of research and writing sort of just naturally fall into the a 1-2-3 arrangement, yeah, exactly. Where other things you've got to think it through much more carefully and see what's related to what.
Do you you say you try to save a day? When you're writing, can you do that? Say, I'm going to write, you've got your research all done, can you say, I'm going to write every Thursday? Or
yes, I can usually do that, and that's what I try to do. In the summertime, of course, one has more, since I have never taught it here in the summertime, and you asked earlier about support. For a whole variety of reasons, and sometimes as a reward for administrative work or sometimes for this or that, I have never taught here in the summer. I've had support here in the summer all the time. One summer I did teach at Johns Hopkins, and one summer I think I only got paid half time. But other than that, I have one way or another had support in the summer without teaching. Obviously, if you've got the flexibility of the summer, this helps a good deal in putting together and giving you some freedom in writing, where you can start working on something and keep going on it, because interruptions in writing time can be very difficult to handle. If you're really going well, you need to keep on.
That's what I should think. That's why I wonder if you could do this.
Yes, you really have to keep going once you get into it. But you can break. I mean, some breaks don't hurt at all. Sometimes it's wise to take a break, either because you know that you seem to be stopped and therefore you better get away from it a bit. And one's always amazed at how some answers suddenly come to you when you haven't even been thinking about that. And I know it happens to me, and I'm sure it happens to everybody else. You've been writing something, and you just don't see how you can go along with this particular direction, or there isn't anything here that's